by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, home of the four-day Wall-to-Wall Guitar Festival featuring 25 exceptional guitarists, including Taj Mahal, Rory Block, Sergio and Odier Assad, Daniel Lanois, Cindy Cashdollar, Bill Frisell, Juan Martin, and Vernon Reed. For more information about Wall-to-Wall Guitar, September 29th through October 2nd, visit KrannertCenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat Sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the abolitionist John Brown. David Reynolds is our guest. His latest book is John Brown, Abolitionist, the Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. David Reynolds argues that Brown, who he says went to murderous extremes in his abolitionist fight, sparked the Civil War to a degree that no other American did. Reynolds says the Civil War and emancipation might have been slower in coming had Brown not acted as he did, murdering five people in Kansas, liberating slaves in Missouri, and raiding the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The book, which Reynolds calls a cultural biography, asks some intriguing questions about Brown and his tactics that resonate with us today, including, when does principled resistance become anarchic brutality, and how can a murderer be viewed as a heroic freedom fighter? Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Reynolds is Distinguished Professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College at the City University of New York. He is the author of two previous books, Walt Whitman's America and Beneath the American Renaissance. His new book, John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights, is published by Knopf. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Reynolds, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me, Celeste.
Sure.
Wonderful to be here.
Maybe to begin with, you would talk with us about your choice of verbs for the subtitle, Killed, Sparked, and Ceded.
Yeah, the reason I say killed, he didn't really end slavery because that happened, with the amendments that were passed about 5 years after his death. But when he attacked Harper's Ferry, the commotion caused by that, the polarization and the effects of that, the ripple effects of that, set in motion the process that that helped to end slavery. And a fellow abolitionist, Wendell Phillips, said that as a result of this event, slavery is like a fallen pine tree. It's still green, but it's dying from the roots. So in that sense, that's the sense really that I use killed. And then sparked the Civil War. I try to argue, and a lot of reviewers agree with me, that basically there was incredible combustible material in America at that time. It was almost like an open gasoline, a tank or something like that. And he is the one who provided that final spark that really created this intense polarization, and hence was shortly, within 19 months, Civil War broke out, causing the deaths, of course, of over 620,000 Americans, more Americans than in all other wars combined. And then ceded civil rights, the idea of ceding civil rights, there's a direct line from John Brown through African-American writers and reformers in the two or three decades after him, leading right up to the NAACP and the most important early meeting of the Niagara Movement, which was W.E.B. Du Bois's movement that gave birth to the NAACP, which in turn gave birth to modern civil rights. That meeting was held at Harper's Ferry, and it was in honor of John Brown. W.E.B. Du Bois specifically said that I want to dedicate my movement to the man who died for my race, for African Americans. So that's where I get the idea of ceded civil rights.
Hmm. You open the story at a party on the day of the Emancipation Proclamation. The proclamation being signed on January 1st, 1863, and the party was held in a mansion, the home of George Stearns. And while they celebrated Lincoln's proclamation, they were people who had their doubts about Lincoln. Would you talk with us about that and tell us about their racial views and how it was, maybe we're getting a little ahead, maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but about how Lincoln saw Brown.
Right. Well, the reason that a lot of people at the party had doubts about Lincoln was that he was sort of a latecomer to emancipation. His initial, he hated slavery just as much as John Brown did, but his initial reason for going to war was to preserve the American Union after the South had seceded, the Southern states had seceded. And then slowly he did make it a war for emancipation. He was very much a constitutionalist. He wanted to try to work within the Constitution. He reluctantly went to war and did so only after the firing on Fort Sumter. And it's not that he didn't like, he obviously hated slavery, but he was a colonizationist, someone who wanted to emancipate the blacks and then ship them abroad to Liberia or Central America because he believed that they couldn't get along with the whites in America, that the races just would never coexist equally in America. So that's why a number of people at the party had certain doubts about Lincoln, and it was called the John Brown Party because John Brown was isolated as really the person who had been the martyr for blacks. He had lived among African Americans. He had died for Frederick Douglass, the greatest black leader of the 19th century, said, "I lived for black people. John Brown died. He gave his life for black people." And so that's why that party was held on the day of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm. Now, everyone there at that party was, as you say, joined by an idealistic vision of a man who in other circles was branded as a murderer, a thief, and an insane fanatic.
Yeah.
Talk with us about how Brown was seen north and south by whites and blacks.
Well, when he raided Harper's Ferry, he raided it with 21 men hoping to free the slaves there, liberate them, and flee to the mountains. And instead, he was captured and later hanged. And initially, the North totally rejected him. Why? Because the North was basically pacifist. Most of the abolitionists were non-resistant pacifists. And the South, ironically enough, found him very cool and courageous, and most of the early praise came from the South. Obviously, the Southerners hated what he stood for, but they were a macho culture. The South at that time believed in the Southern gentleman, the idea, and that included this kind of machismo and aggressiveness and violence and dueling, bowie knives, that kind of thing, the family feud, killing each other off and so forth, and lynching. So ironically, in those very early days, they said, this guy's actually a pretty cool dude, even though obviously we hate his guts. And the North said, who is this crazy jerk? He's ridiculous. But then the leading intellectual of the North, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said, "When John Brown dies, he will make the gallows as glorious as the cross." And comparing him to Jesus Christ, and Henry David Thoreau did the same thing, and Bronson Alcott. these very influential intellectuals suddenly were comparing him to Jesus Christ, and suddenly the North did a complete flip-flop and said, "No, wait a minute, John Brown, look what he did. Maybe he is much more heroic than we thought, and maybe in his case the violence was actually justified." And when that started happening, of course, the South completely demonized him, and then that very, very intense polarization came about, so that even people like Lincoln were called John Brown supporters on the part of Southerners, started tarring Abe Lincoln even with the John Brown Harper's Ferry thing. Meanwhile, Lincoln hated the idea of Harper's Ferry, even though he admired John Brown's heroism and so forth. So, and also the story of the Pottawatomie massacre, mm-hmm. in Kansas, where John Brown a few years earlier had raided these cabins at midnight and murdered five pro-slavery people, that began to be played up in the press. And so then in some circles he was considered a horrible murderer. Although at that time in the North, increasingly he was venerated. So that song, "John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave, but his soul keeps marching on," was the most popular war song that was sung by the Union troops as they marched south to try to free the slaves.
Yeah, and the melody would go on to become the battle hymn of the Republic.
Yeah, it goes, "Glory, glory, hallelujah." Yeah. And Julia Ward Howe heard that the John Brown song being sung in Washington, and she woke up at 4 in the morning and said, "I'm going to really write a song about America, the battle hymn of the Republic, based on John Brown," on the John Brown song.
Speaking of ironies, John Wilkes Booth held John Brown in esteem. He disagreed with his politics,
but
he held him in high regard.
There were a lot of correspondences between John Brown and the Civil War, because he was captured by Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart, who were leaders of the Confederacy. Stonewall Jackson was at his hanging, and so was John Wilkes Booth, John Wilkes Booth was like a ham-bone actor of the day. He's like a... in a way, the good-looking, Brad Pitt of his day. His father was a great actor, but he was sort of a, melodramatic actor, and he saw John Brown hanging there. And obviously, John Wilkes Booth hated everything that John Brown stood for, but in his diary, not long before he killed Lincoln, he said John Brown was the grandest man of the 19th century, the grandest man. Why? Because he changed history with a single stroke. And this is what John Wilkes Booth wanted to be to do himself. He wanted to change history with a single stroke, but he wanted to be John Brown in reverse.
Hmm. Brown, you say, was a devout Calvinist. He believed he was predestined to stamp out slavery. He was, you say, a true Puritan. What should we know about his religious views in light of the fact that later he's compared to Christ?
Yeah, well, as a devout Calvinist, the Puritans who settled New England were basically Calvinists. They believed in an angry, judgmental God, the God of the Old Testament, basically. And they believed in predestination, the idea that God determines everything. And John Brown accepted this point of view, and he believed that he was actually predestined to stamp out slavery. He accepted this notion of the angry God, and he thought that the angry God really spoke through him, that God was angry, not at Southerners per se, but just at the immoral institution of slavery. So actually, John Brown befriended most of his Southern captors that in jail. In fact, he didn't want to be freed from jail because he didn't want the Southerners to get hurt. So it's not that he hated Southerners whatsoever. It's just that the institution of slavery to him was completely immoral. And so he believed that God was really speaking through him.
Yeah. He believed that the Sabbath was to be strictly observed, but he chose Sundays to stage his raid in Kansas and on Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, that was kind of, well, it was ironic, but I guess from his point of view, I think he was making a point. And the point was that on God's day, that's the day that this great foul stain of slavery, which involved the enslavement of nearly 4 million African Americans, that was the day that he chose to try to do his part to stamp it out.
Yeah. the commandments, keep holy the Sabbath and thou shalt not kill. How did he reconcile?
Yeah, I know. Well, he initially had been a pacifist, and he had a conscientious objector against going to the army and so forth early on. He was not by nature violent, but what happened was that in the 1850s, all the laws of that day, the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and the Dred Scott decision were increasingly closing the vice on blacks, excluding them from society, denying them rights. And at the same time, violence was increasing in Kansas, where the pro-slavery party was coming over the border from Missouri and taking over the polling booths in Kansas and electing these fraudulent pro-slavery governments and using quite a lot of violence. And of the 36 murders committed over the slavery issue, 28 of them were committed by the pro-slavery side. So he was really retaliating against the overwhelming violence of the pro-slavery faction. And that's how he saw it. He was just pushed to the edge by the eternal bullying and violence and murder. And also he saw slavery itself as a state of war against an entire race, that slavery itself was a system of torture, of rape, of murder, and of enforced labor without pay.
Yeah. When did John Brown begin to hold slavery in contempt?
From a very, very early age. His parents were abolitionists, and he was born in 1800, and at age 12, when he saw a slave boy being beaten, he went to a family that happened to hold a slave, and he started playing with the boy, and you know, it was having fun, and the boy is very intelligent, and more so, John Brown thought, than he himself. And yet he, as a white boy, was accepted at the dinner table and coddled and praised, whereas the black boy was shoved outside and beaten with a shovel and other household instruments. And he said, from that moment on, I swore eternal war against slavery, even though at that time he wasn't yet, he didn't know that he was going to use violence someday. But at that point, you know, he thought that maybe he'd use other kinds of persuasion or something against slavery. But really, from a very young age, he was anti-slavery.
Yeah. His parents seemed to be quite interesting people, Owen Brown and Ruth Mills Brown, married 1793. They moved to the frontier in 1805. And I wonder if their view, their relations with the Indians who were living there also helped shape John Brown's ideas about human dignity.
Yeah, they were a very racially open family. They believed in kind treatment of the Native Americans. John Brown played with Native American children and reportedly was went through a kind of mock initiation ceremony into a tribe of children and so forth and learned some of the Native American language. And when he grew up and was a farmer, John Brown, you know, a neighbor of his came over and said, look, let's you and I get together, get our rifles out, and let's shoot these Indians off of our property, because there were some Native Americans living nearby. And John Brown said, I'd rather take my rifle and shoot you off my property. You know, he hated any form of racial discrimination, and it really began with his relationships with Native Americans.
Hmm. What were his early efforts in the fight against slavery?
His earliest efforts were through the Underground Railroad, which was that process whereby escaped slaves were directed north. And so he would fairly regularly take fugitive slaves into his house, hide them, and then pass them north. He also taught African-American children, even though he had 20 children of his own, although only 8 of them outlived him. But anyway, he had a full family of his own, but he still took time to try to educate African-American children. And later on, he became involved in, well, he founded the League of Gileadites, which was an armed league of blacks. This was after the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, and blacks were being chased, hunted down in the north. And so he formed a group in Massachusetts of armed blacks and encouraging them to use their arms if there was any attempt at capture of them.
Yeah. So then it's by 1850 he is consumed. The abolition is a consuming passion for him.
Yes, consuming passion. And at that point he moves up to North Elba, New York, in a farm among a huge colony of African Americans, most of them ex-slaves, fugitive slaves living up there in the open countryside. Why did he move up there? Because he wanted to help spur the economy, the local economy, to make them productive, to help them learn farming techniques. And that's where he chose to live, and that's where he chose to be buried. That's where he is buried.
Yeah. Tell us about the speech Brown gave on January 15th, 1851. Quite amazing. And his audience were blacks. And one can, you know, you do this in your book. You imagine what it was like to be there and to hear this call to arms.
Yeah. I mean, in effect, the only comparable thing before this was were like David Walker's appeal. David Walker, of course, was an African American orator and writer who said, "Rise up, my brethren," you know, even if you use arms and so forth. But John Brown was really the first white person. It's interesting because a lot of people today even think of John Brown as being black. But I think the reason that a lot of people think that is that, since he did live among blacks and he gave this speech in which he said, you know, my brothers and sisters, he was also a women's rights advocate, he said, you really must arm yourselves and be prepared to kill somebody if you are being unfairly dragged down. He was so against the fugitive slave law, whereby even if you were in Boston and if you had managed to escape slavery, that you could be dragged back into slavery, put back into chains, and sent out into the cotton fields again. So, yeah, he gave this very, very militant speech to this group of blacks.
Hmm. How many black people then took up arms with John Brown?
He held a convention in Canada in which there were scores of black people, and he encouraged them to join him. And Harriet Tubman actually wanted to. She was a famous black leader in the Underground Railroad, and she wanted to join him at Harper's Ferry, but apparently was ill and couldn't make it. He asked Frederick Douglass to join him, but Douglass thought it was going to be a suicidal mission, which in effect it turned out to be. But in the end, five African Americans joined him. So there were five African Americans, and then there were 16 whites, including John Brown, among the band that raided Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, and if it, in one sense, it failed, in another sense, I suppose you could say, ultimately,
yeah,
it succeeded.
Yeah. What happened is that, you know, he actually had a good idea. Most biographers before me have called him crazy for thinking he could dislodge the slavery system. But his idea if he had done it, if he gotten away with it, it could have been effective. His idea was to free some slaves in the area and take these slaves into the mountains. These mountains ran very deep into the south. He knew them pretty well because he'd been a surveyor. And use the caves, the rocks, the cliffs, to hide out, and to make periodic kind of terror raids on southern plantations. And there was nothing that southerners feared more than slave revolts or slave escapes. And if suddenly there was all this insurrections, revolt going on among the slaves, caused by who knows, who's causing all this? It's a little bit like Bin Laden in the mountains. That he really hoped that he could bring the South to the point where the South would say, all right, let's compromise on this issue. Maybe we can have gradual emancipation here. Maybe we can compromise in some way with the North. This is becoming untenable, this institution, because there's just too much slave revolt going on here. So his idea was okay. The thing is, he did stall a little too long at Harper's Ferry, and so instead of escaping to the mountains, he was trapped by Robert E. Lee and his troops. And but in a sense, he succeeded, because then when he was hanged a couple of months later, he became a martyr, And when he was in prison, shortly before he was executed, he says, "I realized that the greatest thing I can do right now is to hang by the neck." You know, he said, that's what I yearn to do, and that's the greatest thing that I can do for the black race.
Mm-hmm. Martyr or terrorist, how do you see him?
I see him as a little bit of both. I see him more as a revolutionary than a terrorist, but I see him ultimately as a martyr. I really do. I think in Kansas he was more of a terrorist or a revolutionary, and then he was transformed really into an anti-slavery martyr by the end.
How was he able to get away with, if you will, what happened in Kansas at Pottawatomie?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that there had been 36 political murders committed between 1855 and 1858, and a lot of those murders went unredressed. And indeed, over 80% of the murders committed in the South over the slavery issue, that is to say, against white abolitionists who were visiting the South, who were lynched, murdered, or against free blacks, 80% of those went unredressed as well. So there was this kind of culture of anti-slavery and pro-slavery violence that and political murder that, in a sense, people could sort of do it and get away with it. But particularly in Kansas, where the legal system was in such disarray, he was pursued, but he gathered a band of people. He had about 25 followers at that time, and they stood off some federal troops that chased him, and that he won actually a couple of armed battles after that of people who were trying to capture him.
When he was hanged in 1859 for Harper's Ferry, how well known was the Pottawatomie incident?
It was fairly well known by that time, and a lot of biographers have, or people before me have said it wasn't known at all, otherwise nobody would have liked him. But it had been announced, described, along with John Brown's name, on the floor of the Senate in 1856, not long after it happened. And I've gone back. It was mentioned in the most popular newspaper of the day, the New York Herald, which was very anti-John Brown, and they mentioned, you know, he went in and slaughtered these five people. And it was mentioned by a very, very prominent public forum in Boston, this huge lecture hall where there was this anti-John Brown rally not long after the Harper's Ferry raid. So it was circulating. It was fairly well known. But it was also kind of considered part of the general confusion and chaos and murder going on in Kansas a couple of years earlier. It was known as Bleeding Kansas, and there was a reason why it was known as Bleeding Kansas, because a lot of blood was shed, and not just John Brown's murders.
Mm. David Reynolds is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Seated Civil Rights. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. At his trial for the raid on Harper's Ferry, there was an effort to raise a defense of insanity. Brown insisted he was not insane. Many people have argued otherwise. Was Brown deranged? How do we look at his mental state?
I don't find him insane. I really don't. A lot of people called him insane after his reputation sank, because what happened after the collapse of Reconstruction in 1876, there was that long period of segregation and discrimination, Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow, and that lasted until Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. And it was during that period that a lot of historians called him insane, paranoid, and so forth. But I've gone back and I've looked at all the documents. I've read all of his letters and journals. I don't see any signs of insanity there, that is to say, any kind of loss of concentration, any sense of delusion, any loss. He slept like a baby when he was in prison. any loss of sleep. A lot of the signs of mental instability or something just weren't there. And when that insanity defense thing came up, he just stood up in court and said, "You know, if I wanted to follow that, I would follow it. But I said, I'm not. I don't feel in the least bit insane, and I refuse to follow that defense." I mean, he could have chosen that defense and maybe even gotten away with it because it seems so insane. But his implicit answer was, "How about the country itself?" The country itself had just passed a Supreme Court decision that said that blacks could never have any social rights. They were not citizens. They could never be citizens. That was the Dred Scott decision. And the country also held nearly 4 million blacks in slavery and quite often raping the women and dividing the families and murdering and torturing and so forth. So in that sense, which is more crazy, the country or John Brown? I'm convinced that at that time it was more the country that was crazy.
Yeah. At the same time, though, today, as I sit here and consider these issues and I think about John Brown and I think about how he saw God as the true judge and he was God's servant, and so therefore he was an enforcer of divine law. I find that troubling.
Well, it is troubling. And some of his rhetoric sounds like bin Laden. Bin Laden says, "I was predestined by God to wage a jihad against the West," and all this stuff. And some of his rhetoric sounds a little bit like John Brown's. But the difference is that if bin Laden were in power, he would create a Muslim theocracy, a radical Muslim theocracy, in which other views were excluded. John Brown counted among his closest followers Jews, agnostics, atheists, freethinkers, spiritualists, Protestants of different views than his. In other words, he was very open, not only racially open to people of different ethnicities, but to people of different religious viewpoints, even though he was very intense in his own particular religious viewpoint. He was very devoted and close to people of many different religious viewpoints. He was just against that one immoral institution of slavery. And I think there are certain situations, if someone were living in Hitler's Germany, if someone were living in Pol Pot's Cambodia, or let's say Mussolini's Italy, I think that in those particular cases, terrorism, anti-government terrorism, would be justified. And I think in John Brown's case, I think that it had come to the point where violence was really the only answer. Unfortunately, sadly enough.
How do you think John Brown would look upon those who would advocate violence against doctors who perform abortion?
Well, some people have, Paul Hill, who was executed for murdering an abortion doctor, cited John Brown as a person who inspired him. And Timothy McVeigh also idolized John Brown, too. But I personally don't think that John Brown, if he were alive today in America, would use violence for any of the social issues that we confront today, because most of the social issues that we have today are being debated politically, but they don't have the kind of stature of infamy, I think, that slavery had. Slavery was a unique situation, and I do not think he would approve of Paul Hill or Timothy McVeigh or others in recent times in America who have tried to use John Brown to support their radical violence.
Yeah. Well, the one thing you can say about John Brown is that his targets were very specific.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't...
He wasn't a Timothy McVeigh.
He wasn't doing the equivalent of you know, bombing Oklahoma City government building, in which there happened to be some babies and some innocent children. In fact, those murders in which he committed, he didn't just go in and slaughter people. He selected these people who were part of the pro-slavery local government or political party, and he went there, and there were many children there that he didn't touch, and the wives he didn't touch. He took the known pro-slavery fanatics of that area, and so there was a certain selectivity there. And the same thing in Harper's Ferry. He didn't actually intentionally, you know, commit, go in there to commit murder. He wanted to take hostages and then take them to the mountains. So that was it wasn't like the equivalent of taking an airplane and running into these buildings in which there are so many thousands of innocent people of many different political viewpoints. So there was a selectivity there in the violence.
Well, one wonders then if you can say at all that John Brown was a terrorist if he did not believe in if the killing of civilians randomly was anathema to him.
Yeah, I mean that's why I said earlier I like to think of him more as a revolutionary against a corrupt system rather than as a terrorist. I say in my book, I suppose you could call him what Doris Lessing calls a good terrorist, but that word is problematic to use in his case. He did say that he wanted to create a reign of terror in the South from the mountains. So he did want to spark a certain form of terror through these guerrilla raids that he had planned to make from the mountains. So in that sense, and he did use the word terror there, so that's why some people do call him a terrorist. But you're right, it's a problematic word.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's joining us on the toll-free line on a cell phone. Line 4, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call today. I guess I need to turn my radio down, huh? Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. I thank you for taking my call, Mr. Reynolds, and the lady, I'm not sure what her name is, but thank you anyway. I am a Missouri born Kens, and I don't think there's no greater personality ever, hardly in the history of mankind, than John Brown. I'm also a Cherokee African. And like I said, I will always have a certain degree of love in my heart for personalities like John Brown, specifically John Brown himself, because of what he stood for and what he was willing to put his life on the line for. And in a time when we hear about heroism and heroes, it's far-fetched. John Brown was an authentic hero who stood for something that was moral, decent, and just. And for somebody to suggest that he was a fanatic or anything of that nature, given the times and the circumstances of what he was fighting against, they're the ones who are insane and ludicrous. And I see many parallels today, what's going on with the Bush administration, people like that, who is a real authentic terrorist. And so what John Brown did in terms of taking up arms to fight the real terrorist, I feel like he was perfectly within his rights, and that's what we should all be doing if it comes to that.
Well, hopefully it won't come to that, but I basically agree with you, and I think if you read my book, John Brown, Abolitionist, you'll see a similar point of view of John Brown.
Well, I'm going to be sure and get your book, because I'm very much a John Brown fan. I'm a Missouri-born Kansas. I was born right there in that general area where all this turmoil was going on. I wasn't born, of course, then at the time, but yep. I very much am, and I have a few men that I really would say were heroes, but John Brown really stands out as one who's a real authentic hero.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to reading your book, you know. So and I think we're very much at them times again, but for different reasons.
Thanks for looking at my book, and I hope the rest of the listeners do that the same thing, and at least consider the other point of view, which is that he wasn't totally insane. He wasn't crazy.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, David Reynolds, author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Seeded civil rights. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to give us a call, join the discussion with a question or a comment, you're invited to do so. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi, Professor Reynolds.
Yes.
The last caller was rather entertaining, but I'd like to remind him that as a Calvinist, John Calvin was a man who was totally in belief of theocracy and struggled his whole life for that.
Right.
And it's a little strange here because the contradictions are just monumental. What do you know about Frederick Douglass's attempt to win Brown over to the ideas of European scientific socialism? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. as you say, on the point of view of John Calvin, who was the founder of Calvinism, being a believer in theocracy. The difference was that John Brown was a Calvinist, but he was born after the American Revolution and the separation of church and state. So he was very much of a post-American Revolution Calvinist. That is to say, someone who was very devoted to Calvinistic Christianity, but was also very devoted to religious toleration and really anti-theocracy. So his was a very special brand of Calvinism. And Frederick Douglass always had a little bit of ambivalence about John Brown. He tried to. Frederick Douglass's first choice was not violence, and Frederick Douglass refused to come to Harper's Ferry. And even though Frederick Douglass was part of the Secret Six of supporters of John Brown, after Harper's Ferry, he actually fled to England because he feared capture. Being captured and being incriminated as part of the planning party of the Harper's Ferry raid. So there were disagreements between him and John Brown. Ultimately, I think history proved John Brown right because it did take the bloodiest war in our history to loosen the vice of slavery, to get rid of slavery. We also have to remember that Southerners in that day thought that slavery was a very Christian, beautiful thing. It was very good for blacks. It was very good for whites, so much so that many Southerners wanted to go to Africa and enslave all the Africans there to spread the blessings of Christianity and civilization over in Africa. So we have to put John Brown in that context.
Yeah. We're running down now on time. We only have a couple minutes left. A question that you take up at the end of the book, where would we be today if it had not been for John Brown? Maybe we could end by ruminating on that question here a little bit.
Well, let's pretend that, there are so many what-ifs. What if the Civil War hadn't happened? If it had happened later, maybe the South would have won. People forget that twice during the war, the South almost won the war. So what would happen if, in a later war, the South won the war? But anyway, let's pretend that we didn't have John Brown in the picture at all. Perhaps civil rights might have come a little bit later. And it seems to me that John Brown, stood for a moral principle. He went to rather extreme ends to enforce this moral principle. But everywhere I look today, I see versions of John Brown. I see John Brown's influence. Wherever I see people of different races, of different ethnicities, of different religions mixing together, I don't think we've totally achieved complete integration. I think it's naive to think that we were there yet. But I think that we're much, much closer today as a result of John Brown.
Mm. How has the book been reviewed in the South?
Generally, it's been nicely good. A very nice review in Miami, a nice review in Atlanta, a very nice review in Alabama, a good review in Texas. Generally, the reviews all over have been very, very good. There was one Southerner, I forgot what paper it appeared is in, who just hates John Brown, just detests him. And so that person thought I was being a kind of trendy historian or something like that, who was who's going over backwards or something in my sympathy, you know, for what she called, my sympathy for minorities. I thought that was a ridiculous statement and offensive, and I actually, anyway, but just that one case but generally the reviews there, it was the most widely reviewed book in America, by the way, for a week.
Really?
Between in late April. It was the most widely reviewed book, so the reviewers have been very, very positive and very encouraging, and I certainly hope your listeners will sample the book. The book should be in most bookstores. It's on Amazon and so forth. So
yeah. Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, when we began, a lot of the questions that are raised in this story resonate with us today.
Yes, absolutely.
Very much so. Yeah. David Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, Celeste, it's wonderful to have been here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. David Reynolds is the author of John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. The book is published by Knopf. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste, from the Board of Trade this afternoon. Quiet day at the board. Futures finished like this. In the wheat pit, futures were up anywhere between 1.5 to 2 cents for the day. Corn up 2 to 5, and the beans were off about 1 to 2 cents. And the nearbys, the deferreds, were up 0.5 cent. Here's the way the numbers settled at the Board of Trade in the wheat pit. July, or rather September wheat, at 331 high, low at 328. The settlement price there at $3.30.5. They were up 2. December contract, $3.45.5. The high, the low at 42. Settlement price at $3.45.25 for a bushel of wheat, up 1.75 for the December contract. March contract now, $3.59.5. The high, low at 54.5. Settlement price at $3.58, up 2. And the May contract up a penny and a half, $3.63.5. The settlement price. And that was up on the high as well, the low at $3.60 for the May wheat of next year. July futures for next year, $3.66, the high, the low at $3.63.5, and a settlement price there at $3.65.75, up 3/4. From the corn pit, September futures, $2.37, the high, low at $2.33.5, settlement price at $2.36.5, and they were up 2.25 for the day. December contract, $2.48.25, the high, the low at $2.44.5, settled $2.47.75, up 2.5 cents. March contract in the corn pit, $2.55.75, the high, low at $2.51.5, settlement price at $2.55.25, up 3.25, and the May contract at $2.60 high, low at $2.56, settled $2.59.5, up 3.75. July futures in the corn pit, $2.64, the high, the low at $0.59, settlement price at $2.63.5, up 4.25, and September's $2.61, the high, the low at $55.5, and a settlement price at $2.60.5, up 5.75. If you've been watching your DTNs, you may have noted that Wilhelmy is saying that many of the traders at the Port of Trade are thinking now that the highs are in for both the beans and the corn. We'll talk a little bit about that with Paul Cooley this afternoon during the closing market report and see what he has to say about the marketplace. That happens at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. September futures for the oats, $1.69, the high, the low at $1.66. Settlement price at $1.67.5, down 2.25. December futures down 2.25 as well, $1.73.5, the high, the low at $0.71. Settlement price at $1.71.75 for a December oat contract. Final for the day. August soybeans, $6.79.5, the high, the low at $6.71. Their settlement price, $6.73, down 2.25. And the September futures, $6.84, the high, the low at $6.75. Settled $6.78, down 1.25. November contract, $6.93.5, the high, the low at $83.5. And a settlement price at $6.86.5 for the November soybeans. They were down 2.5 cents today. January futures, $6.96, the high, the low at $88. Settlement price at $89, down 3 cents. And the March futures, $6.92, the high, the low at $6.84.5. And a settlement price at $6.86.5, up 0.5 for the day. May contract up 0.5 as well. $6.78.5, the settlement price for the May soybeans of next year. The low at $74, the high at $83. Bean meal, August contract, a dime higher, $2.15.30, the high, the low at $212.50, and a settlement price at $213.50. Once again, they were up 10 cents. September futures, $214.50, the high for the soybean meal, the low at $211.70, settled $212.60, they were up 40 for the day. August soybean oil, $24.55, the high, the low at $24.26, and a settlement price at $24.31, down 12. And the September futures, $24.65, the high, the low at $24.33, settlement price there at $24.39, and they were down 9 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Mostly higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange, Todd. August feeder cattle, the high today, 107.30, the low 106.72.5, the settlement 107.12.5, that down 12.5. September, 106 even, the high 105.25, the low, the settlement 105.67.5, that up 10. October, 105.15, the high 104.35, the low, the settlement 104.97.5, that up 10. August live cattle 79.50, the high 78.90, the low 79.35, the settlement, that up 20. October 81.60, the high 81 even, the low, the settlement 81.37.5, that up 20. August lean hog 67.85, the high 66.90, the low 67.50, the settlement, that down 5. October 57.10, the high 56.20, the low 56.62.5, the settlement, that down 10. December 55.25, the high, the low 54.80, the settlement 55.20, that up 12.5. And February lean hogs 57.90, the high 57.40, the low, finishing at 57.87.5, that up a nickel. And August pork bellies 77.95, the high 75.65, the low, the settlement 77.95. That up $2. The Dow is up 50 points at 10,630. The NASDAQ up 8 at 2184. The S&P 500 5 higher at 1236.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rich Toohey from Seattle, Washington writes, Dear Dr. Science, chickens? I don't have any questions about chickens. Do other people have questions about chickens? I'd like to hear those questions.
Well, I checked our chicken file, and discounting the ones about chickens crossing the road and the ever-frequent McNugget question, we get precious few questions concerning chickens. Now, turkeys are much more popular, as are hamsters, guinea pigs, and lab rats. Someday I ought to publish just a book of your questions. I could call it 20 Years of Collected Ignorance. Who knows, it might hit the New York Times bestseller list like a bullet.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 75 degrees in Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director this afternoon. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look now.